Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland.
He was like a tenacious bulldog.
He was intimidated by nobody.
He was absolutely amazing.
He's the most decorated detective in the history of the NYPD.
He knew every part of the Bronx like the back of his hand.
He made more off-duty arrests than some officers made in their whole career on duty.
He cut his teeth working the mean streets of the Bronx during New York's deadliest years.
They don't make cops like Ralph anymore.
His name is Ralph Friedman.
He's the true warrior.
These are his stories.
Arrests, 100 off-duty arrests, 6,000 assists, 15 shootings. These are not the performance statistics of an entire police squad. They belong to Ralph Friedman, a living legend and arguably the toughest cop to ever wear the shield. Ralph is the New York City Police Department's most decorated officer in their 170-year history. During New York's most dire times in the 1970s and 80s, gangs, organized crime, social unrest, the heroin boom, robberies, murders, mayhem. Ralph spent his career on the streets of NYPD's 41st Precinct, better known as Fort Apache, the Bronx. Ralph arrived in the profession almost by accident.
I never really thought of becoming a cop. I was just a regular guy. And what happened was I was out with a few guys, and I said, what are you doing tomorrow? It was this Friday night. And they said, oh, we're going to take the police test. And I said, the police test? I was like shocked. At those years, it was a walk-in test. You didn't have to file, and there was nothing to do. You just walk into the school. So they tell me that it was being given in Clinton High School in the Bronx, and that's where I graduated, and I lived in the Bronx. So I said, I didn't even think much of it at the time. I said, you know what? Knock on my door. If I wake up, I'll go with you. And when they knocked on my door, and I was up, and I went. I just walked in and took the test. And after I took the test and I walked out of there, then I was sort of, I never thought of becoming a cop. You know, I've got brought in a couple of times for fighting, but I wasn't arrested. I got like JD cards, like juvenile delinquent. And I got a couple of summonses for speeding and things like that. I never thought of becoming a cop. But once I took that test, I said, wow, you know, this could be pretty exciting. You know, it could be a career where, you know, I could advance myself without college, because you didn't need college to become a cop then either, like you do today.
Now at 71 years of age, he reflects back to being 19 years old when he was hired by the NYPD.
About a year went by, less than a year went by, and they called me. But it was January of 68, and I was too young to become a cop. So you had to be 21. I was 19 now at the time. So they hired me as a police trainee, which means you're going to become a cop, but you got to work indoors doing things that cops do on the indoors, no law enforcement duties. And what you did was you wore a gray uniform, and you perform inside duties until you're approaching the age of 21, and then you'd go into the police academy and then go out on the street. So I did fingerprinting and TS duty, you know, telephone switchboard. I did reports, stuff like that until I became 21. And then I went into the academy, got my training. It was a four-month thing in the academy.
Ralph graduated the academy and was dropped into the infamous 41st Precinct alone.
I got assigned to the 41st Precinct, which was Fort Apache. It had a reputation as being the toughest, most dangerous place to work in the United States. And I was happy I was going there because I wanted to break in a busy place and be involved in the action. And, you know, we didn't break in with, like, field training officers. You know, when you went to the precinct after the academy, you were just put in the street. And all you had was your gun, your nightstick, your common sense, and your guts. And it was really a learning experience.
Ralph was inspired by the veteran officers he worked alongside.
And the camaraderie in the 4-1 made me want to stay there. And I looked up to the guys that were in the precinct coming in with arrests and stuff. And, you know, it's funny, a couple of guys that influenced my career that I looked up to, I wound up later being their partners. Seeing some of the cops that were in the precinct at the time, I was in awe, you know, and I just said I wanted to be like that. You know, I saw these guys coming in with these vicious animals that they met on the street, and they bringing in guns and drugs. And I just said that I got to be like that. I got to be like that. I want to be like that. And I did, you know, I ate it up like a kid in a candy store.
Fort Apache was the then standard bearer example of deterioration of our inner cities.
It was the poster boy for urban decay, drugs, and violence. It was like a Wild West show out there. It was, you know, you've seen, I lived in the Bronx, and this was the South Bronx, and I lived in the North Bronx. And I lived next to this all the time and never saw it. I grew up in an area, it was all Jewish, Italian, and Irish. And, you know, I never really mixed with these other ethnic backgrounds until I got to the South Bronx. And it was like only a couple of miles away from me, but yet a world apart, you know, and I never knew until I got there about drugs. You know, I was never exposed to that. I didn't know about the violence that was so close to me. I didn't know for the disregard for human life that was over there.
Like all cops, Ralph started with routine rookie assignments. He began to climb the investigator's ladder and build trusted relationships.
I did about a year in uniform, which you do while you're in uniform. You do, you know, you're a rookie. Then you do all the, get stuck with all the shit assignments. You know, you handle it. You get stuck with DOAs and psychos. And then you do foot, you're doing foot posts. And then you work your way into a radio car and you start to develop with steady partners. And I did anti-crime patrol, which is plain clothes. You're not a detective yet, but you're in plain clothes. And your job is basically to be involved with the crime, to be there when it's occurring. And like a uniform deters crime and a detective investigates cases after the fact. My job was to be there while it occurs, catch these bad guys in the act while they're committing the crime, and then being able to testify against them. And we had a very high conviction rate. And you do form a camaraderie with all the officers there, plain clothes, detectives, and uniforms, because your life is in danger out there. Every minute that you're working, your life's in danger. And you rely on these people as your backup and your partners. When I was in the 4-1, I was there for 5 years until I made detective in 1975. And I could easily say my best partner in the 41st was a partner named Les Rudnick. I had a lot of good partners, though. I had partners of Kenny Mann and Bobby DeMattis and Eddie Fennell. But my best was Lester Rudnick, who I became close with and had many arrests with and, you know, life-threatening experiences with. And when I made detective in 1975, my best partner then was, without a doubt, Timmy Kennedy. And both of these men, being very close with them on duty, we were very close off duty. But, you know, my life was in their hands and their lives were in my hands. And you form that bond with a partner and that you rely on, you know. We knew each other, you know, we could have a conversation without saying a word, if you know what I mean. You know, and we did that when we stopped perpetrators, followed suspects, and, you know, we worked like a fine oiled machine.
As a rookie, Ralph responded to a situation that is forever burned into his memory 50 years later.
I was a rookie. I was in uniform, and we got a call to a hostage situation. And the place was surrounded. This guy took his common law wife and her kids hostage. And it was a barricaded situation. And the wife finally escaped, and the son escaped. But this guy was holding the 7-year-old girl hostage. And it finally came to where we were moving in. And he was holding a big butcher knife to this girl. And without a second's notice, he wound up swinging the knife and cut her arm off. And I had my gun up, and I was ready to shoot this guy. And my finger was tightening on the trigger. And before I could pull that trigger, he so quickly raised that knife and cut his own head off. And, you know, it that lasting impression of that little innocent girl getting hacked with that knife, I'll always remember that. You know, they put her in an ambulance, she died right away from the loss of blood, but I'll always remember that scene.
Another traumatic event in Ralph's career is when, during a violent confrontation, his actions and reaction saved his partner's life.
And the second one that comes to mind right away is I came back from court one time, and I started, my partner wasn't working, and my shift was changed. So I had to work with another guy from my unit, who I've worked with a few times, but wasn't my steady partner. His name was Cal Unger. And we went out on patrol. It was about midday, around noon. And we were patrolling in his Volkswagen Beetle, which was pretty unusual, but we were blending into the neighborhood as anti-crime officers. And we usually don't take radio runs, but a radio run came over of a burglary in progress. And the uniform officers picked up the case, right? And they were responding. So we picked it up as their backup. Because like I said, in the 4-1, there's a camaraderie, and you're not going to let even uniform officers go to a scene that you consider pretty dangerous, which is really everything, but you back them up. So we backed them up, and what happened was we got there first. So we drew our guns, we went into the building, and of course the job is on the top floor, and there's never an elevator. There were no elevators in this whole precinct. So we go up to the building, and we get up there, and we're up on the 5th floor, and we hear a girl screaming. And we look at the door, and we could see the door is open about 6 to 8 inches, and the framework is like it was kicked in. And then we hear a scream again. So we entered this apartment shoulder to shoulder next to each other, and when we get in there, it is pitch black. And it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon now, right? They had sheets and blankets and drapes and all kinds of shit on the windows. It's pitch black. And we're trying to get our eyes adjusted to it. And we have our guns drawn. And when we walked in the apartment, we're in this big room, like a living room. But now we hear another screech, another scream, like a blood-curdling scream from a girl. And it's in this rear room. So we're adjusting our sight, and we could see there's a bathroom at the end of the hallway. Say it's about 10 or 15 feet hallway. And the bathroom is facing you, and there's a door off to your right, which was the bedroom. So we start to approach that because that's where the scream was coming from. And all of a sudden, a guy jumps out of the room, confronts us from 3 feet away in this hallway, and starts shooting. And immediately, we both start firing, not really even being able to see the guy that good, but you could see the muzzle flash. And we start firing at him. Right away, my partner goes down. But as he's going down, he's emptying his gun. And I'm standing there firing. And this is all taking place in a matter of flash of seconds. And all you see is like strobe lights of all the gunfire going off, a lot of smoke. And in this hallway now, the bullets, we all fired six rounds. And the bullets are ricocheting, so it's more than 18 rounds going, right? And at this point in the second, flash of a second, I fired five rounds at him. And he crashes into my body trying to run past me, even though he's been hit multiple times. And I shoot him, my gun pressed against him. I shot him right in the heart at that time. And he went down, and somehow, by the grace of God, I wasn't hit. But my partner took six bullets, winds up, we carry him downstairs, because we didn't wait for an ambulance, and we get him into a radio car, right? And there's so many cars respond to an officer down that the car couldn't even get out of its own way. He had to back in and hit cars to get out of the way, and guys were scrambling to move cars. Meanwhile, we radioed ahead, and we had highway patrol block every intersection. So they could go with light and siren, but not even think about looking either way. And it was like a guided missile right to the hospital. And my partner got to the hospital, and he had to take 72 pints of blood within 3 hours, which was a medical miracle back then. Might still be today. But they saved his life, and he was shot in a sack, that, a sack under the heart that holds fluid. So it's actually like a heart shot. But they saved his life. He's still alive today, thank God. And the perpetrator died at the scene. And those were two of the most terrible things. But, you know, I did save his life and my own life, and I felt good about that. But it was terrible that my partner had to take those hits. But thank God he survived.
That wasn't Ralph's first experience with gunplay. He never considered himself off-duty. That on-the-job protector mindset placed him in the middle of a violent confrontation.
So I was home, I was working out, listening to music, and I get a call from this girl I was dating that she was out shopping with her mother, and two guys, for no reason, started harassing them, pushing them around, slapping the mother, and threw them on the floor. So I raced out of my house, raced up to the scene, which was about 3 miles away, and there was a big crowd in the street there and everything, and they tell me that two guys just left in a truck. So I race up the block, catch the truck, and I pull them over. And it was two brothers. They get out of the truck, and they're both armed, right in full view. And this is like in the afternoon, sunlight. And they both got tire irons in their hands, right? And we later found out they'd been drinking, so they had beer balls. And they didn't give a shit. I had a gun pointed at them. I tell them to drop the weapon. And the guy comes at me swinging, right? So I just still didn't shoot. You know, it's my first shooting. I'm trying to, you know, take care of this without using deadly physical force. But the guy swings and hits me right in. He swings for my head, and I block it with my shooting hand. And he hits me right in the hand. He breaks my bone. But I don't let go of the gun. And I push him back, knowing the other guy is going to come up behind me. But it was too late. Before I could turn around, the guy smashes me over the head with the tire iron, cracks my head open, and blood's all over and fills my eyes. And I turn around with my gun extended. And when I turn around, my gun gets stuck somewhere. So I know it's against him. And I fire. My gun was under his throat. And the bullet went in his throat, comes out the other side of his throat, goes in his shoulder, and comes out the back of his shoulder. I put four holes in him with one bullet, right? And I turn around because I know the other guy's behind me. And just as I turn around, the pipe's coming down to my head, but a police officer's hand catches the pipe, stopping the pipe from hitting me in the head again, which would have caved in my skull and probably would have killed me.
Ralph credits his partners in God for having survived 15 combat shooting incidents.
I've definitely pushed the envelope. And, I mean, thanks to great partners, great cops in the area, and God, I did make it through. I've been in 15 shootouts, well, 13 shootouts, actually, and then two other shooting incidents where I had to shoot dogs. I wound up shooting 8 perpetrators, killing 4 of them. And obviously it does sound like a lot because of other officers go through a 20-year career or 30-year career and never have to use their gun. But I did this all in 14 years. But it was a very small percentage if you compare it to the amount of perpetrators that I took off the streets. You know, I had a crazy amount of arrests. I've effected 2,000 arrests and assisted in thousands of others. But the shooting incidents, when you compare it to those numbers, is a small incident, even though it would be a lot for other officers.
New York's infamous drug kingpins, Frank Lucas and Nicky Barnes, were driving the city's heroin boom. Ralph was a firsthand witness to the aftermath.
Well, they were around when I was there, and they were, they didn't care about their people. You're right, they didn't care at all. They were dealing death, and all they cared about was making money. You know, and we were protecting the people, and, you know, it was like shoveling shit against the tide. But that's how it was, you know. You know, there's big money in drugs, always was, and I guess there always will be. We dealt with a lot of junkies because they were the ones doing the crime. I mean, when you're a junkie, you would do anything to get that money, to get that fix. And, you know, when they were high, they were out there doing a lot of shit. And when they were coming down, it was like walking among zombies. You know, they'd be nodding out, sleeping in the streets, in the doorways, in the hallways, as in shooting up galleries, you know, drug dens, shooting galleries, we'd call them, where they'd go and share needles and stuff. And they were zombies. But when they were high, they were doing a lot of the crime. They would do burglaries and muggings, and stick-ups. It was like, I don't follow this show that's out now called The Walking Dead, but I would imagine it's like that. You know, because it's about zombies.
Ralph found satisfaction in everyday, standard police work.
I've worked a lot of homicides. I've done big robbery cases, stick-up teams. But the one that sticks out the best was I was still in my anti-crime mode. And I would do my cases, but also go out and make pickup collars. And anything that uniforms told me, I would follow up. And these uniform officers responded to an assault. This woman called the police because her ex-husband came to New York and slapped her around a little. So she called the police, and they made a report. And as they were leaving the apartment, the woman says, "Oh, by the way, my husband's wanted by the FBI. I call warrants, and I find out the guy is wanted. Then I call the FBI, and they tell me this guy broke out of federal prison in California, and he owes 30 years for a bank robbery. He owes another 6 when he was tried in absentia for escape. So he owes 36 years, and he's like 6'3", 270 pounds, and he's armed and dangerous and vows never to be taken alive." Basically, they told me, "Listen, don't bother. We couldn't get him. You certainly won't." So I get off the phone and I tell my boss what we get. He says to me and my partner, he says, "Could we get this guy?" I said, "If you take me off the chart, we'll get him." So when you say take him off the chart, that means like New York City detectives catch like 5-6 cases a day. You know, at the end of the week, you got like 25 cases. My boss says, "I'll take you off the chart. You guys go after him." I say, "We'll get him, boss." We follow all our leads. We wound up catching him outside of New York in Long Beach, Long Island. And it took us like 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and we caught the guy. When we caught him, he had a monstrous German Shepherd with him, and he had a gun in his hand. But it was in his pocket. His hand was on the gun. And we snuck up on him on a boardwalk, and we took him down in front of hundreds of people without endangering anybody else, and we had him contained. We had a gun in each of his ears and one in his mouth. From three different directions we came.
Ralph's career was prematurely cut short when he was crushed in a vehicle collision with another police unit while responding to the call for an officer in danger.
Over the years, I broke like 50 bones, but I broke 23 in that car accident alone. You know, and ironically, I got hit by a police car. You know, with all the interactions and all the fighting and all the shootings and all the people that I've disarmed hundreds of people where I didn't have to use my gun or deadly physical force. But all those things over the course of 14 years, ironically, what stopped me and put me out of commission was a rookie cop driving a police car. We were going to the same emergency. So I used to do about 98% of the driving, but I let my partner drive. Not that it was his fault. And we were racing. A cop was calling for help. That's a single 1013 where everyone responds at a high rate of speed. You want to get there to help this cop because he's in danger. What happened was we were driving west, and we were going to go to the end of the street and make a left, which would put us heading south to where the call was coming from. But before we could turn left, and we were heading west, a radio car heading from the north, heading south, T-boned me. And they never touched their brakes. You needed 30 feet of rubber to tell how fast the car was going back then. And there was zero amount of rubber, which means they never touched the brakes. And they slammed in, they T-boned me, hitting me right in the hip on the passenger side at a very high rate of speed. And everybody was injured. The two uniform officers that were in the car, and me and my partner. But they were all treated and released in the same night, but I wound up in the hospital with 23 broken bones. My hip was shattered in 100 pieces, and I broke my pelvic, left, right, upper, and lower. I was in the hospital for 2.5 months. And then I left in a wheelchair, and that's what ended my career. Ironic, right? And believe it or not, I didn't even get surgery or a stitch. I had so much muscle on me that acted as a shock absorber, and they hung me in traction. I couldn't move anything but my mouth, which I'm doing now, right?
Ralph has been honored with every award the New York City Police Department has to offer, some more than once. He is the most decorated officer in the NYPD's history.
Well, you know, as it was happening and I'm getting these medals and getting awards, you know, you don't think of that. You know, you just do your job. And, you know, I was eating up the action. I actually lived on an adrenaline rush. You know, I guess that was my drug. You know, I never did drugs. But this was a drug your body produces. And, you know, I'm very proud of the title. And I was always proud to be part of the New York City Police Department. And really, you know, everything I did, it's not an I. You know, it's always a team effort. And, you know, I do credit all my partners, my bosses, and all the backup officers that made this possible. You know, I couldn't have done it on my own. You know, you couldn't fight the whole Bronx or the whole city by yourself. You know, and... you know, I give credit to all these people that helped make it that way. And I'm always proud of the title. You know, I was proud of being a police officer. I was proud of being a detective, proud of being part of the police department. You know, it's that in itself is a badge of honor. You know, when you're part of law enforcement, you know, I consider it an exclusive group that I was honored to be part of. You know, I was honored then, and I still wear it as a badge of honor today. I'm proud to say I was part of it. Police Department.
Ralph holds strong opinions on modern-day policing, how society views the profession, and how some situations were addressed by old-school beat cops.
Policing has drastically changed. I say today's cops and law enforcement as a whole, when I say police, when I'm saying NYPD, I'm talking about everybody, you know, FBI, ATF, every city, town, state police. Policies have changed for the worse. I don't feel they let the police do their jobs, and yet police are trained much better. You know, I think the training and the technology is tremendous today, but they don't let law enforcement officers do their job to the fullest. I think politics got in the way of law enforcement. Attitudes got in the way. They say all lives matter. I don't believe in that either. I don't believe that drug traffickers, people that abuse elderly, people that abuse infants, people that terrorize and mutilate people, terrorists that set off bombs, I don't think their lives matter. I tell you the truth, they mean shit to me, you know. Decent people's lives matter. Police officers' lives matter. Working people's lives matter. Doctors, nurses, not people that, you know, I've seen infants that were raped. I've seen infants that have been burnt with cigarettes. People that do that, their lives don't matter. You know, they just don't matter to me. If you had to bring in a guy like that, if I get a guy who burns an infant 20 times with a cigarette, I could tell you before I capture him that he's going to resist arrest. You get my drift? He has to get some street justice. You just can't take him in and have some judge say, oh, it's okay, he can walk. You know, that just ain't going to happen on my watch. Some people might call that police brutality, but I call it street justice. And I think any decent people would agree with me. If you get five guys, five muscular teenage guys that beat up an 85-year-old woman, I think they deserve street justice. And if you call that brutality, then I'm into brutality.
Ralph considers it his greatest accomplishment in protecting the lives of the public and those of his partners.
Being in the shootouts that I were, that I was able to save my partner's life and my own life. You know, people always, you know, when they hear that I've had to take four lives in the line of duty, the most common question people ask me is, how did you feel afterwards? And, you know, I'm not going to lie and say, oh, I felt traumatized or I had to take a life. You know, you don't go out there setting out to say, I'm going to take a life. You don't wake up and say, I want to kill someone today. But it happens in the line of duty. And I don't regret it. I'll be honest with you, I felt very good after I had to do it because I know I saved my partner's life on my own. It's a victorious feeling. You went into combat just like a soldier, and you had to kill people to survive or for you to live, and or your fellow soldier or your fellow officer. And I felt good. I felt victorious. I felt I did the right thing at the right time, and I survived. I dealt with violent, vicious animals on the street that would have taken my life or my partner's, and if they would do that to a cop who's armed and trained, imagine what they would be doing to a civilian. These are the people that rape, rob, and kill and have no regard for human life. And putting them out of society is, I felt like I did a good deed.
Ralph's lessons learned to young lawmen are the example of why he is so adored. He reflects on his love for his partners.
Well, my words of wisdom would be always watch your partner's back. You know, do the right thing, but always protect your partner. And, you know, your goal is to protect people, but overall, you have to go home at the end of your shift. You know, so watch your partner's back, be alert, and policing is a dangerous assignment. You know, it's a very dangerous profession, and you got to be sharp and ready at all times. Don't take anything for granted, and always be on point.
Maybe Ralph's greatest achievement is the lasting relationship he holds with his wife, who has stood by his side for 36 years of marriage.
A side note of all this, I'm still with the same girl. I'm married to the girl that was with me when I had this accident. I was dating her for 4 months before the accident, and I was dating about six or seven other girls at the time. And when I got hurt, they all showed up at the hospital. But this one girl knew that She knew I was a very determined people, and I would overcome the prognosis that the doctors had for me. The first night, they said there was a chance I might die. And after the first night, they said I'd survive, but I'd probably be a cripple and never walk again and all this kind of stuff. And this girl knew I was going to overcome that. And she hung in there. She came to the hospital every single day, and she didn't have a car. She came after work, and then the police would drive her home. But she came every single day I was in the hospital, and she met these other girls, and they all faded out. You know, some lasted a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They were gone. She came every day, and when I got out of the hospital, that's when they took the protection away. While I was in the hospital, I had an officer. When I got home, she moved in and took care of me. To this day, I'm still with her 36 years later. You know, she hung in there, and after, you know, there was one day I woke up and all seven girls were around the bed. So they all ran into each other. I didn't even know what to say. I just made like I passed out from drugs again. I didn't even want to deal with it. That might have been the most dangerous position I was in. but seriously, she hung in there, and I'm still with her. And that's a great accomplishment in my life also, being with the same woman, even though, you know, when I was young, I had played around a lot, but, you know, I was really always a one-woman man, you know, and meeting her, and we're on the same page. We're still together after 36 years. I think that's a big accomplishment in any generation.
The story of Ralph Friedman's career can be found in his book, Street Warrior, and is available online or wherever you buy your books. A tribute to Ralph's respect and credibility is found in one of the book's endorsements, from none other than the worldwide Hell's Angels celebrity, Chuck Zito.
I've known Ralph Friedman for almost 40 years. Since the first day he walked into Big Joe's tattoo shop, he looked more like a biker than a cop. We were on opposite sides of the fence, but we always respected each other. He's the toughest Jew I know and has more tattoos than I do.
Ralph still adheres to an aggressive physical fitness routine, and when coupled with his knowledge and experience, it allows him to continue to work in the private security industry. Ralph hosted a television series based on his life and career titled Street Justice, The Bronx. He continues to serve as a consultant to the entertainment industry, most recently as a part of the soon-to-be-released film The Many Saints of Newark. Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless, and go be amazing.